This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. It's springtime in Iowa. The fishing is good. It's also a good time to catch those showers in a rain barrel, assuming that you don't max out your credit card. Those are our three topics for the hour today. If you love catching those great Iowa crappies and trout, the Iowa DNR has a new internet tool you may find valuable. Interactive web map showing fishing spots. What's there to catch? Vic Clemesrud of the DNR will tell us about it. And then on to rolling out the barrels, rain barrels, that is. The 65-gallon Moby rain barrels have been selling like hotcakes in Iowa. It's a great way to capture rainwater runoff. Jen Isles of the Indian Creek Nature Center explains the concept. And finally, some tips to help us control our use of credit. Tahira Hira of Iowa State University recently launched the website Money Sense with the New York Stock Exchange to help consumers improve their money management skills. Talk of Iowa following this hour's news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Where are the fish biting in Iowa? You can ask a fellow fisherman or check out a new website from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Interactive map that features 50 top fishing spots identified by DNR fisheries experts. Mick Clemesrud of the Iowa DNR says spring is the best time to fish. Mick, there's now an interactive web map on the DNR website with the best spring fishing spots. It's really, I played with it for a while, it's really rather nice. You click on a city or tells you where the fish are and what spots, rivers, lakes, whatever. So how did you come up with this idea?
Well, actually the city of Oregon in Oregon had done this before. It's in around the metro area of Portland. And what they did was they created a site that say, where's the top 50 places to fish that are 50 miles from downtown Portland, and they identified all those, and they tried to make it as interactive and user-friendly as possible. So actually, you know, like any other good idea, we just stole it.
How long did it take you to actually do all this work to get all these sites logged in? I've never put together anything like this before. It's pretty impressive.
Well, we visited with our fisheries biologists, the people who are on the ground, and actually they're the ones that provide the fishing reports. And we asked them each spring, you know, where, if somebody called me today and said, I've got one day to go fishing, where should I go? What should I fish for? So they gave us this information based on the best areas in their districts. So we compiled that, and I said, you know, give me a list of fishing tips and that kind of thing. So we compiled all that information, and we put it on the mapping system. And then we also included links for if you wanted to see the latest fishing report. There's a link there if you wanted to, you know, if you needed information on regulations. There is information there. We also are going to be adding a link to our lake maps. If there's a one of the new lake maps available for any of these lakes we have identified on here, we'll have a link back to the new map. Plus, if you've used the system at all and you have a GPS and the capabilities, which I don't, but if you did have that capability, you could actually select a number of these areas and download the information into your GPS. So if you go out driving in the country and you're trying to find one of these more remote areas, you'll have that capability.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, Minnesota brags about its 10,000 lakes, and I think is it Manitoba that has on its license plate 100,000 lakes? It's one of the Canadian provinces. I can't remember, but Iowa has, you know, probably what, hundreds of lakes and ponds and streams, something like that. Enough, right?
Yeah, we have about 80,000 farm ponds in the state, and more than 250 lakes across the state. That's from Spirit Lake on down to like Lake Geode in southeast Iowa. But what we also talk about is we grow big fish. Our ponds are as fertile as our land is for growing crops. We grow a lot of fish. They can support a lot of fish in the system. They grow big fish. They grow quickly. So we're a very productive state, not only on the land, but also in our lakes and ponds. So, you know, we always encourage people to go out and go fishing and keep these fish and take them home. They're a great resource. They're a good part of your diet. We're going to grow more. So, it's a great resource. It's a great time. And this time of year, we are right now at the very peak of the spring fishing. It's the best fishing of the season, bar none. For the next 3 or 4 weeks, you're going to have a lot of fish that are close to shore. They're very aggressive. They're willing to bite. And I took my kids fishing yesterday, and it is just a tremendous time to get them out there because they're going to have success, and they're going to be excited about it, watching their bobber go down. It's a good way to spend some quality family time.
So spring is the best time to fish. The fish are just more aggressive. Why is that?
Well, it's the nature's call. It's annual spawning season for fish. They're going to be they're going to shed some of their normal wariness. They're going to be closer to shore. A lot of these spawning areas are in water that's less than 5 feet deep, and that's, you know, found typically near shore. So these fish are going to be in there. They're going to be real aggressive, trying to jockey for spawning position, and they'll strike out at things. A little bit before and a little bit after the spawn, you're going to see fish that are recuperating, and they'll be hungry, and so they'll still be eating. But, you know, as this time period fades off into mid-June or so, and summer's heat starts cranking up, you're not going to have these fish. They're going to move offshore, move to deeper water, and then you're going to have to go out in a boat and chase them. That's the second thing I was going to mention about this time of year, because you don't need a boat. These fish are real close to shore. A lot of our lakes we've designed to have fish attracting structures like rock piles or pea gravel areas or stake beds that are close to shore. We're trying to bring these fish close to the people, so you don't need a boat. Well, now this spawning season takes care of that on its own. These fish are going to be pouring into shore, real aggressive, not very, you know, they don't have that normal caution that you have to overcome. They're going to strike out and bite all day long.
So Iowa has big fish. We grow big fish. I'd never heard anybody say that before.
Yeah, we do. We have a tremendous fishery in this state. We have got some of the best bass fishing. Our bluegills are tremendous. They grow big and plump here. We've got excellent walleye fishing. We grow muskies up to 50 inches and northern pike. And our hatchery system is very good at what it does. They produce a lot of fish. They've studied these fish that we grow, and they stock them in a way that these fish are going to have success in the system, and they're just not going to be throwing a bucket of eggs out there and not taking. They've really studied this thing. They know what they're doing, and we're right in the middle of that too. So you're going to see, you could see some of our stocking going on, but we grow a lot of fish. Like I said, our lakes are very fertile, and just like the crops that we grow on the ground, we grow big fish and lots of them.
So a big reason we have such great fish, you're saying, is that our DNR, Department of Natural Resources, fish hatcheries. Maybe people don't realize how much they contribute to quality of fishing, right?
That's true. You know, we have very limited to zero natural reproduction for some fish species, like walleye, like muskies, that type of thing. And so we grow, we go out in the spring, we collect these fish, we strip them of their eggs, we return them back to the lakes, the adults, and in our hatcheries, we'll hatch these fish out, we'll grow them to a certain size. It could be shortly after hatching, it could be up to 2 inches or up to 5 inches, or for muskies, we'll hold them for a year, and we'll grow it up to about 11 inches, and then we'll release these fish in the systems, and you know, they're very good at what they do. We grow a lot of fish. In fact, we supply fish to other states. If we have an excess, we'll trade them for, like, wipers, for example, like we did with Kansas and Oklahoma. They would like our walleyes and our muskies, and we want their wipers. So we'll trade fish, and that'll give us another unique species. And if you've ever caught a wiper, if you ever go to Lake Manawa, or if you're in one of these big federal reservoirs like Sailorville or Red Rock or Coralville, and you hook onto a wiper, you better be ready for a tussle, because that thing will burn up a reel if you're not ready for it.
I'm sorry, this is you call it a wiper? How do you spell it?
It's a W-I-P-E-R. It's a cross between a ocean striped bass and a white bass.
I see. In the world of fishing, what is Iowa's best-known fish? What do people maybe come to Iowa for?
Well, before we had a limit on our panfish, we had people come from all over the Midwest to fish crappies at Iowa at Lake Rathbun. It was a big draw. Illinois, Missouri, Wisconsin, Nebraska. They used to come all over southern Iowa and southwest Iowa to fish for crappies. And in northern Iowa, we'd draw them from South Dakota and again from Wisconsin and Minnesota to fish in Nebraska to fish for, there's excellent panfish fishing in West Okoboji Lake, bluegills in particular, but we also have a tremendous walleye fishery and northern pike fishery in Big Spirit Lake and a muskie fishery in Big Spirit in West Okoboji. And in addition, we've got tremendous trout fishing in northeast Iowa. We've got 43 streams now showing a quality natural reproduction, and there's just a lot of neat things going on out there.
What were you and your kids fishing for last night? Just curious.
We went after panfish, bluegills and crappies. They're easy to catch. They're plentiful. They do naturally reproduce here in large numbers. And it's fun because they're a hard-fighting fish, and we like to eat them.
So how is the spring fishing season going here in Iowa? Is it a good time?
Yeah, we've had such up and down weather. That's kind of impacted it somewhat. But within the last week, we've seen a marked increase in the amount of active lakes that are having really excellent fishing, and it should continue through this weekend and next week, and on into about the second week of June. So we're really hitting the stride right now.
How many people fish in Iowa? Any idea?
Well, we sell about 300. And last year, we sold about 385,000 fishing licenses. Now, we estimate about 500,000 will fish, because Iowa residents under 16 do not need a fishing license. Plus, if you're 65 and older, you can purchase a lifetime license. So you have to factor all those people in. So it's around 500,000, maybe a little bit more.
You say that Iowa has, what, 800 farm ponds or something like that? Was that the figure?
That's about 80,000.
80,000 farm ponds. Are these there for fishing purposes mostly, or...
Well, it's private property.
Yeah.
In the past, we had stocked these as part of our farm pond stocking program. And, you know, what we do is we request that landowners, if somebody would knock on their door and ask to fish it, that they would grant permission to these people. Those fish were being provided by a hatchery in southeast Iowa that, you know, was paid for by fishing license sales. So that was kind of the give and take. We'll provide you these fish. If people do ask, it would be nice if you would let them do that. Well, now there's actually a fee that is charged with that, but we still ask them if they would let people on, but it's completely up to the landowner. They have control of it. A lot of places, if you just knock on a door, you're going to have a, yeah, sure, go ahead, just leave the bass, or, you know, take as many as you want, or that kind of thing. People still have to follow the rules that are in the regulations book. And it's a common misconception that if you fish on a farm pond, you don't need a license. That's incorrect.
Oh, yeah.
All farm pond, fishing in a farm pond, you're required to have a fishing license. So it's, you know, all the regulations still apply to that. So,
Mick, thanks so much. Good luck with your fishing this spring. Sounds like you're having fun already with it.
It's a great time, Dennis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mick Clemesrud of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. You can find the interactive fishing map at www.iowadnr.gov/fish/map. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute.
Pool swam three little fishies and a mama fishy too.
Swim,
said the mama fishy.
Swim if you can.
And they swam and they swam all over the dam.
Boop, 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 diddum, doddum, waddum, toot. Or you will get lost.
But the three little fishies didn't want to be bossed. So three little fishies went off on a spree. They swam and they swam right out to sea. Swam and they swam right out to sea. Yeah, the little fishies.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. During a good rainstorm, you can't believe how much water pours off your roof. Enough to fill a 65-gallon rain barrel, or several rain barrels. Now the old-fashioned rain barrels are back in vogue and selling like crazy. The Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids is getting a second shipment of 300 rain barrels. Jan Eels of the center says collecting rainwater is a big way to prevent floods, and your plants will love the water. Jan, it looks like you've got a one final shipment of, 300 rain barrels coming in to the Indian Creek Nature Center, which implies that you've been selling a lot of these rain barrels in the last few weeks. Is that right?
Oh, we have. We had a shipment come in just around Earth Day of 300, and since then the orders have been rolling in. So we anticipate to complete another order of 300 by June 5th when our next shipment will arrive.
So explain the basic idea here. Why one would purchase a rain barrel?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, it's kind of a matter of principle. You know, all of our properties produce water that runs off and enters local streams and contributes to flooding. And I have a rain barrel on my home at home, because I can that way control the runoff from my property. I can catch it and reuse it in my garden and on my lawn rather than watch it go down the gutter into the storm sewer. It's free water. It's wonderful for gardening. It doesn't have any, it's not treated through, a chemical water treatment process, so it doesn't have any of the additives that they put in it, nor is there any cost that goes into it to treating it. So it's really excellent for your plants. Also, it just seems like the right thing to do. It's a very environmental thing to do.
So this is a 65-gallon rain barrel. You call it Moby, as in Moby Dick. Where did the name Moby come from? Just wondering.
Well, I think that the company that produces the barrel, which is Rainwater Solutions, gave it that title.
How long does it take to fill one of these up? What do you attach your downspout to it, and one good rain fills it up, or how does it work?
Yes, a good rain will definitely fill one, and that kind of depends on how much the area of your roof is draining into that particular spigot that you've put the barrel on. If it's a larger roof area, you're going to fill your barrel much faster than if it's smaller. Many people have bought more than one, and they attach. They have an overflow hose that when one barrel fills, it immediately starts to fill the second barrel, and that way you can store more water for future. And it's really nice if you're a gardener. If we get into a long dry spell, if you're a gardener, you're using municipal water to water your plants, water that you're paying for. So storing it in a rain barrel really helps on the old water bill. They're gravity fed. There's no pumps required. You simply attach the rain barrel to your downspout with a little bit of a diverter that sends the water into it. It has a lid that can be locked down. The
right.
Lid is childproof, and it has a screen at the top that the water goes through that strains it. So if there's any debris off of your roof, that does not go in your barrel. That screen also keeps mosquitoes out, so you don't have the issue of mosquitoes getting in there and laying eggs.
Yeah. Who thought of this idea? Because I had a neighbor when I was growing up decades ago who would collect rainwater in just buckets, but I had never heard of rain barrels being used until just fairly recently.
I think the idea actually goes back to probably the 1800s. Many years ago, when you built a home, you diverted the rainwater off of your roof into a cistern underground, and you pumped that water back up and used it. And many people, if they didn't have a cistern, caught that water in barrels at the corner of their houses. And that was often the source of water for baths and washing your hair and things like that. It's excellent for rinsing your hair.
Yeah.
Best softener there is.
I always wondered what cisterns were used for back then.
I remember my grandma's farm. We had a cistern on the farm. Yeah.
I should know more about rainwater. But, you don't drink it. But is it in the plants? I'm sure it's better for plants because it doesn't have chlorine and stuff in it that the city water supply would have. But is it sort of like soft water?
It is soft, yes.
So it's naturally soft water. That's interesting.
Yeah.
My downspouts go right down to the ground. I would have to probably modify those to feed them into the rain barrel. But I suppose that's something that even I could figure out how to do, I suppose, couldn't I?
It's really pretty simple. You just need a hacksaw. And you cut your downspout off, and at the bottom of it is the elbow, and you reinsert the elbow at the point you cut it off at the top of the rain barrel, and then that elbow diverts the water right onto the top of the rain barrel lid, which then catches it and strains it and puts it into the barrel. At the bottom of the barrel, then, there's a spigot that a standard hose attaches to, and the spigot is raised. The water pressure from all the water in the barrel forces water out through your hose. The overflow hose attaches to the top part of the rain barrel so that, if your barrel should fill, it's not going to overflow. It runs into another container. And you could put another rain barrel there. You could put a garbage can there or some other container to catch that overflow. Or a lot of people are telling me they're directing that hose into a garden area that they, might want watered, and they just let it drain into an area like that. Or they may have established a rain garden, a special garden of plants that really like wet soil. So you just divert it into there, and you let those plants be happy with all that extra water.
Are people buying more than one? You said that you could connect two as an overflow, but how many do people sometimes have more than that?
They do. I've seen systems where they'll attach six or seven of them together. And interestingly enough, people who bought one in our first sale are calling us back and saying, I want another one.
Wow.
You know, may, putting in a second order.
Now, for people who haven't seen them and they might be thinking, well, I don't want big, ugly objects sitting around my house. I mean, what do they look like?
Okay, the Moby, the Moby's made out of plastic. It's made out of totally recycled plastic. It is black, so it's not, you know, it's just kind of a discreet color. It isn't any more objectionable sitting by your house than maybe your Yardie is or your blue recycling bin is that we all have by our houses that we use. And a lot of people green them. They'll either plant large plants around them or they may make a little screen of lattice, put that around it that it isn't real noticeable. You know, there's ways of making them very attractive. And you can paint them. There are plastic paints that will adhere to the plastic. So if you want to be artsy and decorate them, you can do that too.
This seems to be just a nationwide phenomenon. I'm reading about it that they're selling like hotcakes all over the country. I mean, it's pretty exciting to think that this is such a simple idea that it can do so much to help the environment and help with you know flooding and that sort of thing. But it's people are buying them all over the country, right?
That's true. They are a hot item right now. You find them in all the gardening catalogs, and people that live in areas where it's a drier climate really depend on them to catch that water for gardening purposes.
And we don't live in a dry climate
no,
here,
we
so we have lots of rain. So I would imagine if you fill up your barrels, if you're not using that water a lot for plants, it'll last a long time.
It will. And, you know, a rain barrel, you know, the whole purpose of putting these in is, yes, if you're a gardener, it's excellent for your gardening purposes. But on a bigger scale, if you're really trying to capture your runoff from your property and control it within your own property, the next step to this is probably thinking about installing a rain garden, which is an area that has special plants in it, and it may have a little bit of a dip to it that water tends to settle in there, and it catches rainwater, but then that water infiltrates into the ground very quickly and disappears. So, you know, rain barrel is a kind of one step in a whole series of environmentally appropriate things to do with your home landscaping.
Rain gardens. I haven't heard of that. It sounds very interesting.
Oh, and maybe fantastic.
A topic for another interview at some point. I'm intrigued by the idea.
We have one here at the Nature Center under one of our downspouts. Our water from inside of the barn goes directly into the rain garden.
Wow. And finally, what's the procedure for people getting one of these or more than one of these next rain barrels that are coming into the Indian Creek Nature Center?
Okay. You can go to the Nature Center's website, which is our name, IndianCreekNatureCenter.org. And right on the front page, there's a place that says Every Gallon Counts. And you just push that button, and it'll take you directly to where you can order them with a credit card. If you don't want to go on the Internet and do that, you can call the Nature Center at 319-362-0664, and we can take an order for you, and you can send us a check, and we can take care of it that way.
Yeah, thanks so very much.
Well, thank you for calling us and thinking about us. We appreciate your support.
Jan Ailes of the Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids. Talk of Iowa continues in just a few minutes here on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese. Not having control over your use of credit can result in devastating outcomes for consumers. It's according to an Iowa State University professor of personal finance and consumer economics. Dr. Tahira Hira has assisted the New York Stock Exchange in setting up a new website, Money Sense. The site is to help individuals with money management skills. Dr. Hira isn't happy with the high interest that credit card companies charge, but she puts the ultimate responsibility on consumers to curb our credit card addiction. Dr. Hira, I want to ask you about the Money Sense website. You're one of the organizers and major contributors to this. The idea is to get some practical advice to consumers on money matters, right?
Right. Well, I am a chair of the Financial Literacy Advisory Committee to New York Stock Exchange. And in that capacity, I played a very, it's a six-member committee, very important and busy people. So as a chair, before we publicly announced the committee, I had been working with the Stock Exchange has a team, which they call product team, who was developing this website. As if you have logged onto it, it's very beautiful and very useful. The spirit of this project was to focus on adult Americans, current employees, and more specifically, employees of the companies that are listed on Stock Exchange. So we wanted, that's our long-term project.
Well, let me ask you, why is there all of this interest lately in financial literacy? There just seems to be, there's more websites, there's more authorities, there's more books being written about financial literacy for the average person. Why this big change, and why all of this interest in it all of a sudden?
Why is that interest? And I have a feeling that is because of what's happening to our economy. All the troubles that we have created with our own actions, people are now worried and they're saying perhaps we should learn how to make decisions better. And we're looking towards two things that have happened. You know, the country is facing financial difficulties for the last five years or something, and not still getting back on towards the very encouraging side is not here yet, closer to us. The second thing is that I think we have also come to realize that what individuals do, or what we make them do, or families or individuals, or if you want to call them consumers, again, I have some problem with that word as well, what they do, and if most of them end up having poor decisions made, then that's not good for business or for the state or for the country. So I think we have come to that also. So we are saying that we need to enable them to be able to make better decisions.
Well, much of what you have talked about over the years has been on managing debt, credit cards, especially for people who have such problems with credit cards. And I know you say there's one golden rule when it comes to debt. What is that?
Well, one golden rule is that you don't borrow for consumption purposes. You know, you really don't do that. You don't artificially start to live a life which is not really your life, meaning which you cannot afford. You need to know what your income is. You need to know what that income can buy you. You need to be comfortable and truthful to yourself. And then you need to know what are the right reasons and right purposes to borrow. Borrowing has its place. If it's handled properly, it's very useful. But when we are given a tool like a credit card, it is very useful and it's also very destructive. So is the tool bad? Actually, it is the user of the tool that is not using it properly is where we can put the focus on.
When you say it can be very destructive, I mean, what do you mean by that?
The destructive is that it allows, before you know it, people shift or cross the line from using the credit card to make the payment and paying the bill at the end of the month. That is the constructive use. But when one time you decide or you casually said, this month I can't pay the full bill, and they're telling me I don't have to, I can pay partial payment, or I can even pay minimum payment like this, and I don't really have to worry about the rest of it. Really very nice, very attractive. I can pay this much money, and I do that. Well, that is, you cross the line. You cross the line into the path that will become very destructive. Because what you didn't understand, number one, that you started to borrow money for items that you consume, which have no value over the long term. And number two, tomorrow when you charge $10 or $15 or $20, whichever it is that you do, for buying whatever consumption item, you will now start to pay 18% interest rate on that. So now all of a sudden you turn your, and not only on the balance, but also on any additional purchase that you made. So you have now turned your card into a tool, a borrowing tool, at the most high interest level that you can ever imagine.
When you say that people would use the credit card for something that has no, I guess, lasting value, are you saying that people should not be using credit cards for purchases of items like food and restaurant meals? And that's,
this is a very good question you ask, because I want to make it very clear. Using a credit card to buy those things is not wrong.
Yeah.
I use my credit card to buy groceries all the time.
Yeah.
But what's the difference is this, that when I spend that money to buy those things for which I have money in the pocket or in the bank, bill comes and I pay the full bill. The bad thing is not that I saw you using credit card for buying cup of coffee, which, you know, is okay, or lunch or groceries, that's all fine. Use credit card where it is used. But you have to know what is your capability. Money, the credit card does not generate extra or new money for you. You only use that to spend the money that you have so that when the bill comes, you can pay that. That's the most important distinction we need to draw. Credit cards are not bad. You shouldn't be worried about having them or using them. It's just, how do you manage what you charge on that? Are you charging things on it which you can't afford? And are you charging things for when the bill comes at the end of the month you wouldn't have the money to pay?
I don't know how many people I've talked to who've said that they've chopped up their credit cards. They've cut them up, put them in the trash. They have no credit cards. They're proud of that, as if they were getting rid of some sort of an evil force in their life.
And you know why? Because what happened was this: they lost the control, and it cost them a lot of pain. And
yeah.
They got so, either that happened to themselves and they never wanted to touch it again, and or they saw somebody else. Because what happens with the credit cards is it is much, much easier to lose control. You have to be disciplined. You have to be responsible. You have to be in control. You have to be in charge. And when that slips, then it becomes very, very painful for yourself. And when that happened to people, they cut them up, they threw them away because they had lost control.
Yeah.
And maybe for them it is okay to do that for a short while, but you cannot live in this current environment and not know or learn how to use them properly, because there are times and places where you cannot function very well without them. So you cannot be afraid of them. You have to learn how to use them and how not to use them.
Is there such a thing then as a real credit addiction? I hate to use the word addiction,
yeah,
but there is such a thing. But if there is this more of a personality trait of certain people who just can't seem to help themselves when it comes to these financial instruments?
I will say to you this now, like 10 years ago, if you had asked me, there would be a small proportion of people who were getting over their head with the credit card, you know, charging. Again, we have to be very careful. Using credit card is using to purchase an item with credit card is not bad. It is what happens when the bill comes. We need to think about that. We need to understand what that does. So if people were using credit cards and heading towards spending way beyond their means and getting themselves drowned now under the money that they had borrowed on the credit cards that they didn't even know, it was a much smaller proportion. That proportion continued to increase. And that meant that then came time, then people came to the point where they were paying their bills even, they did maxed out on one card, they went to another, they accumulated cards, and then even those minimum payments put together on several cards became so big that they couldn't take care of the essential need-related expenses, like paying the bills on time.
What is your opinion, Dr. Hira, about credit card companies themselves? I mean, people are so angry at credit card companies, and we all use them, but we're all mad at them at the same time. And now they're still...
I tell you what.
Yeah.
We can do that if we want to do that. We can get mad at them. We can get mad at government. We can continue to point fingers to other people. We have asked the companies to change their behavior. So now my question to myself should be, am I being responsible? Have I changed my behavior? Have I given them myself some parameters? What have I learned from myself, what I did? I don't think we can. It is important that we provide somewhat safe, secure, logical, moral, responsible environment in which we can all function. But I don't think that as an individual, all I can do is get mad at everybody else and not get mad at myself.
Right.
I have to get mad at myself. I have to sit down, and I have to look back for 5 years, and I have to ask myself, what could have I done differently, and what, more importantly, what will I do differently from going forward? It's not, you know, nobody puts a gun to my head and tells me to take the credit card to the mall and spend way beyond my means on things that give me satisfaction for maybe 5 minutes, or somebody else has it, or whatever. I can spend 50, you know, let's just give you a very specific example. I'm going to the mall, and somebody asks me, what do you need? And I'm like, no, I'm just going to the mall, see what's there. Okay, so I'm making this trip. I have nothing that I have laid out. I don't need shoes for my, you know, winter. I don't have a winter coat need or blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to the mall. I'm going to spend some money. So what at least I should do is this. I should tell myself, for this trip, when I have nothing in mind that I need, it's a want and I want to just do it for whatever reason. So how much money do you think I should, I'm talking to myself, how much money do you think I should take to do something that I don't have any reason, you know, there's no urgent need, et cetera. Is it 50? Is it 100? Is it 500? What is it? And to control myself, if credit cards take the control away from me, I can just take the cash with me.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I run out of the cash, then I come home.
It does seem like more people may be going that route of late since the Great Recession of 2008. That does it seem like more people are finally becoming aware of some of these basic rules to protect themselves and are, you know, putting away some more money into savings.
Right. You have said something very, very important here. I want to just dwell on that, and I want to say two things to the world when they finally listen to our conversation. That first of all, managing finances is not a rocket science, okay? It's a basic, very basic thing, and it's actually, when it comes to money management, first and foremost, it requires some very basic value system. It requires some beliefs and values that have been ingrained to us or should have been ingrained to us. And these principles are so true and so versatile and so timeless that, you know, thousands of years ago, people were following those principles, and those who followed, they were always well financially, regardless of the income level, regardless of the stage of their life cycle.
And this was in the days before credit cards, right?
No, well, you know, I don't think we can blame anything to credit cards. I think we need to blame on ourselves how we don't manage them properly.
Okay.
We cannot blame things on other things. I mean, I tell you, there is 50% of the people who manage credit cards very well, mind you. Let's learn how to manage them. I think, so the value system that is very important is, and this is a book that somebody wrote and actually in 1920, okay? And his name is George Clausen. And he captured some of the very ancient parables in his series. And I am going to tell you a few of them, which I think makes so much sense. So simple, so workable. Okay, he says, start thy purse. I mean, I'm using the language that he used, okay? Start thy purse fattening. Okay, that's one thing. Fatten your purse. What does he mean by that? For every 10 counts you earn, take out but 9. Okay, the simple thing is always spend less than what you earn. So if I don't know what I earn and I don't know what I spend, and I use credit cards to facilitate my overspending, it's not credit card's fault.
Right.
It's my fault. And then 5 years later, I will realize I'm drowning. And when I'm drowning, then I start to splutter, you know, and do whatever. So he says 10%, you know, save 10%. And it's not 10%, and I think that's too little. I would say you have to save probably 30%. And I tell you what it means. You know, I think you have to set aside 10% for large bills that come every 6 months and 5 months, and that 1 month's salary would not pay that. Then you need to put, so you put money in and take it out, put it in, take it out, put it in, take it out. Then another 20% that every 2 years or 3 years you need to buy something, a car, or, but for some you need to accumulate some money, but every 3 years you will take it out. Maybe you're building a down payment for your home or something like that. And then there is another 20% or something that you put it away and you forget about it. And it just builds that time when you will not be working, which is going to be more than close to one-fourth or one-third of our time. But anyhow, simple principle is spend less than you, always spend less than what you earn. Then he says, control thy expenditure, budget to pay for necessities, luxuries without spending more than that 9 cents that you had. Here is the problem. People can't figure out what's the difference between need and a want.
It's so complicated sometimes. You see something that you
it's
think...
It's not complicated.
It's not.
It's not complicated.
Okay.
It's being irresponsible. Mm. It's being unrealistic. It's being empty inside and trying to fill it with whatever I think I need to.
But this is more of a... This gets into psychology and our deep psychological needs, and the fact is that spending makes a lot of people feel better, right?
That doesn't, 5 years down the road, you're destroyed yourself.
Mm.
I think we're looking for feeling better in the wrong places. Why doesn't it make me feel better? I tell you what makes me feel better. I don't owe anything to anybody. Nobody is coming, calling upon my phone and asking me to make my payments. I'm not worried that I will be able to make my mortgage payment or not. I'm not worried that I don't have money put together for emergency fund. And if I'm fired for 3 months, 6 months, I'll take care of myself. That's what should make us feel better.
You know, just getting back to the credit card companies for a minute, it's still, you say, don't blame them. It's still, when you think about their 20% interest they're charging, it does, you're starting to think that they're really trying to rip us all off somehow.
Who is telling me to go and borrow from them? They can do all they want, but I don't want to borrow from them. I can go to the bank. If I have a right
That's
reason
right.
to borrow, I go to the bank and borrow the money at the wrong, let's say, if I am paying my bill at the end of the month, I really don't care what the interest rate they charge.
Sure.
It's irrelevant to me.
I remember back in the mid, maybe late 60s, when the credit cards were first being developed by these big companies, that they sent them out to everyone in the mail. You didn't even ask for one. My dad got one with a credit limit that was very high. They just sent it to him. And that was the beginning of our credit card empire, I guess, that's developed over the years. Interesting little note there. Do you remember those days?
Do, but I also remember those days, when I don't know whether I was here in '70s if they sent the cards. I was a student. I wasn't thinking about credit cards at all. I had my money. I had saved some even as a student. Credit cards weren't part. I had one for emergencies, like if I'm traveling and I need something bigger amount. But my point is that I remember very clearly when I would get in the mail checks that will say to me around holidays or whenever, sign it here and you can have $5,000, $10,000, whatever. And I would laugh and I will tear them up and throw them away. And I say, who the heck do you think you're fooling? But I will come back to you. I would say to you, they can come to me. I don't have to do it.
Right.
I do not have to do it. If you are true to yourself, if you are in touch with yourself, if you know what you're all about, you can ignore them. And interest rate doesn't mean a diddly-do to me on a credit card because I never, never, never have balances on my credit card.
Not everybody knows what they're all about, and I'm thinking that you're asking people for a lot of self-control. Then not everybody is not everybody's going to have this, right?
Now, let me ask you one thing, okay? You
right.
buy a car, and you have to drive that car. Will you ever... ever without learning how to drive the car, sit in the car and start driving?
No.
Will you?
No, no.
Will you not learn about the rules of the traffic before you get on that road? Will you blame the police that they had a speed limit at this place, but that was bigger and that was higher, and guess you what? I got into the trap and it's their fault. You will never do that.
Right.
No. I think we have to say, and I said earlier, we have to be responsible government with good legislations. We have to be hopefully responsible business people, but we cannot not be responsible individuals in our own life. Nobody makes us do anything.
For people who are just having trouble accomplishing this, the self-control, self-understanding, I mean, what do you recommend that they do? Should they get some counseling, some financial counseling, or how? What's their
do? Very simple things. Take the credit card. Don't walk away with it all the time in your pocket.
Okay.
Put a certain amount of cash in your hand for whatever you need. You live with purpose. You live with purpose. I'm going out today. How much do I allow myself to spend for what purposes? Have I budgeted the money for lunch? Have I budgeted the money for 3 cups of coffee at $4 a day? What have I budgeted for myself? And that is what I give to myself now. Before I can get taken away and lose the control, the only way I will lose the control if I have the credit card with me.
That's an interesting approach. Just don't take the credit card with you, right?
Yes, right.
Okay. Well, I should try that.
Well, you should. You really should try it. Then money management is not about money. It's about you as a person and your value systems and your philosophy of how you live, your philosophy of living within means, your philosophy of not owing things to other people, your philosophy of being responsible for yourself. your philosophy of understanding ups and downs in life, and I'm going to be prepared for it. It doesn't matter whether I'm a young student or whether I'm a parent or a grandparent, young or old. And the second thing is that we're talking about personal finance, and it's a similar thing. In personal finance, we need to talk about the person, and the person is the important piece of it. And we cannot talk about debt unless we also talk about cash flow management, unless we talk about saving, unless we talk about managing our risks. And when we talk about debt, simply, we're just picking one piece of the whole, one piece of the whole. If I manage my cash well, then I wouldn't be borrowing for wrong reasons. If I saved something and learn how to save, I wouldn't be borrowing. If I learn what purposes I should borrow, if I learn that here are the things that I already have and here is something, personal value, property value, and how should I protect them, then I wouldn't get myself into very big loss, for which then I have to again go and borrow. So I really do believe it really starts with me and understanding my value system. And then from there, once we have the right value system, we are very capable of figuring it out, how to live true to those value systems. We are very capable people.
Thanks again so very, very much.
You are most welcome.
Okay, take care. Dr. Tahira Hira is a professor of personal finance and consumer economics at Iowa State University. That's Iowa Public Radio's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. Thanks for listening.